Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the HuffPost Commons People podcast with me, Paul Waugh, Ned Simons and Martha Gill. This week, most of the nation's children and parents have been enjoying a half-term break. But in Hogwarts SW1, there's been no rest for the wicked. From Heathrow's third runway being cleared for takeoff to Brexit by-election, from Michael Gove's comeback to the forgotten war in Yemen, it's been a busy few days. First up is Heathrow, see what I did there? the worst-kept secret and in government is that the airport was finally going to be expanded, and it was confirmed by the Cabinet Subcommittee this week, and Chris Grayling told MPs it was going to be Heathrow, not Gatwick, that would be expanded. Now, Zach Goldsmith got to his feet in the Commons to explain that he wasn't very happy.
I have to tell you, Mr. Speaker, there are so many questions one could ask in a statement of this sort, I wouldn't even know where to begin, so I simply use this opportunity to put my absolute opposition on the record.
Curiously, Zach didn't announce that he was resigning in the House of Commons. And that was honour was left to him telling his local constituency association. Now, Martha, you had the scoop on this. Exactly what was the thinking behind that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the second worst kept secret in Westminster that Zach was going to resign. He's always said he was going to do it. In the sort of big lead up to this this announcement that he was going to resign, all kinds of leaks got out. So when he finally did it, everyone already knew.
He told the House of Commons.
Yes, indeed.
Odd,
well, I mean, it kind of he's had a lot of backing from his association, also neighbouring constituencies and MPs over his decision. And there are rumours that some of them might even come out and campaign for him as an independent, which should be very unusual.
Yeah.
The Tories it's also unusual that the Tories have not slapped him down about this or anyone else who has supported him. Thirdly, unusual that they haven't put up a candidate against him, and I hear that they don't intend to.
Yeah. It was a strange moment in the Commons. I mean, he could have. I mean, we all know Zach's not the best politician.
Yeah.
He's not the best campaigner. He showed that in the mayoral elections in lots of ways. But, you know, all the sketch writers that were in, and so was I, and he sounded like a wet, damp.
Yeah, it was a bit damp, wasn't it?
You
were poised there to write down this explosive condemnation of Heathrow and why he stands, you know, what he's going to do. It was just a bit.
Yeah, it was more whimper than bang, wasn't it? And if he does get defeated, his final words in the House of the Commons as an MP are the ones you've just heard, which is the supreme anti-climax.
It's sort of his calm persona. It makes him look like he doesn't care. I mean, when he was running for mayor, it was a similar kind of problem he had, where it just looked like he wasn't that bothered. When he was against Sadiq, who sort of runs around everywhere, and he's kind of like Energizer Bunny sort of approach to campaigning compared to Zach, who just seems quite
languid, isn't he?
He's sort of shy, diffidence as well. But you know, if you're a politician, you're a politician.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, I mean, declaration here: I am one of his constituents, so I will be getting all this stuff through my letterbox for the next few weeks. And this morning, the government chief whip has moved the writ for the by-election, so it's formally going to happen, and it will be happening on December the 1st. It's going to be a short, sharp campaign, precisely to stop the Lib Dems from building up momentum. Now, Ned, that's because they want to turn it into a Brexit referendum.
I think the Lib Dems, they're feeling quite confident, and they're saying it as well. They're raising expectations with this. They're not just sort of behind the scenes saying, oh, we think we've got a good chance, we don't want to kind of say we do in case we lose. They're publicly saying, you know, we think we've got a really good chance here. I think a good quote from a sort of senior Lib Dem is, you know, we threw the kitchen sink at Whitney, the David Cameron's constituency, we're going to throw like a five-story townhouse at Richmond because they're going to make it all about Brexit. They think Zach Goldsmith, who was for Brexit, they reckon they can focus on that, get the kind of 48%ers in Richmond, which is actually, it's not 48%, it's a lot more than that.
Oh, it's about 72%.
Yeah, it's a large majority for Remain. So they make it about that. They think they feel quite confident they can take Zach out.
And Martha, do you think that I mean, say the Lib Dems do it. Say they have this seismic by-election victory, like all their famous ones from years gone by, from Christchurch to Eastleigh to Romsey. Say they do it in Richmond Park and it becomes another, you know, notch on the Lib Dem by-election bedpost. What do you think Theresa May would do? Would she then pause for thought, thinking, oh, God, I won't go for a snap election in the spring after all. I could lose all these Lib Dem seats in the southwest. Or will she actually think, nah, actually, I'm so far ahead of Labour, I'm going to go for it anyway?
I reckon probably the latter, or the signs are beginning to point towards a May election. Tories are apparently hiring sort of organisers in key constituencies already. Some Labour MPs are gearing up for it. I don't think that the Tories have that much to fear from Lib Dems, even if there is an impressive surge. I mean, the surge would have to be pretty impressive. Also, there are some people who say that the Lib Dems don't stand much chance in Richmond Park because of Zach's sort of personal vote there, and also because of his focus on Heathrow. That's what a lot of the constituents really care about, perhaps even more than Brexit.
That's true, although that's slightly negated by the fact that the Lib Dems are saying, well, if you elect a Lib Dem MP, you've got an even better chance of reducing the government's majority and actually defeating this in a vote.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, for the Lib Dems, if they don't get it, then it's going to look pretty bad for them. Like I said, because they're publicly, they're not being shy about it, which is a dangerous game to play.
It is dangerous. Anyway, on the Brexit theme, Brexit was unusually this week Jeremy Corbyn's main choice of topic at PMQs. He doesn't normally do it, but he did this week. Here he is explaining his search for the government's philosophical influences before Tory MP James Cleverly heckled that Karl Marx was Labour's own real favourite thinker.
I think when you're searching for the real meaning behind and the importance behind the Prime Minister's statement, you have to consult the great philosophers. The only one I can come up with.
Mr. Cleverly, calm yourself. You're imperiling your own health, man, which is a source of great concern to me. Jeremy Corbyn.
What I can come up with, Mr. Speaker, is Baldrick, who says our cunning plan is to have no plan.
Ned, how did that Baldrick gag play out?
I mean, it was okay. And again, I think by Corbyn's standard, he had quite a good PMQ. So I think third in the row, where he did quite well and May wasn't that great. The problem with that Baldrick gag is that Tony Robinson, the actor's name, he was a Labour supporter who doesn't like Corbyn.
Yep.
So he set himself up for an easy comeback for May. And then, of course, all the journalists then can look at his Twitter feed and think, look at all the stuff he said about Corbyn, about how he's rubbish and shouldn't be leader. So why put yourself in that hole?
Yeah, it made you think whether or not Corbyn's PMQs team had done their homework.
They just thought, it won't matter, though, because the cunning plan joke is good enough.
Yeah.
The second follow-up little thing doesn't really matter, which might be the case, because you did see
the cunning... It did get on the clips.
Yeah, you did get on the clips, and you did see that in headlines and using it. So perhaps they thought, on balance, it's worth it, and it might be the right call. But it was a bit of a trap for himself.
Like
surely
everything is.
Surely there's another sort of 20-year-old sitcom we could have found to quote from.
Hello or something.
But it was interesting because, you're right, this week, I mean, like last week, Corbyn got a lot more goodwill from his own backbenches. PMQs these days is not the sort of, you know, the sort of tumbleweed moment on the backbenches it used to be. If people are willing him on, aren't they?
I think you can see it by watching Tom Watson's face. Because for a long time, he just didn't move.
Yeah.
And the last couple weeks, he's actually sort of been laughing and pulling expressions, which I think that's a signal to how it's going. It's really weird.
It's interesting. A lot of MPs said, look, it could be a lot better. You know, he could have quoted the Guardian leaked extract, for example, of Theresa May saying to Goldman Sachs that, you know, she felt that actually, you know, businesses were going to go abroad. There's lots of things he could do.
I don't think he scored sort of like any massive
But
hit
it wasn't
on
a disaster. Yeah. I mean, that's the point. Now, Ned, you went to see John McDonnell, speaking of Brexit, today, and he was giving a speech on Labour's new line on that. What is it?
Well, the first thing to say is he said breakfast three times by mistake, which is a bit of a...
It's a common mistake. Yeah, I mean,
it's an early morning meeting.
You sort of have to forgive him. I think it's quite easy to do, isn't it? So, I mean, his main point is that, you know, if they're going to carve a special deal out for the city, then it's a Brexit for bankers. And why should bankers get a special deal rather than manufacturers or small businesses? Well, he thinks it's quite a good line of attack for Labour to make, actually, the idea that the Tories are still on the side of the city and the kind of rich rather than everyone, like Theresa May said she wanted to be. you know, not just for the privileged few. So it does make sense as a line. I think also the point he's making is that it's a chaotic Brexit, or chaotic breakfast, as he said, which is, you know, why things come out piecemeal, bit by bit, leaks, you know, what's the actual plan here, feeds into the idea of it being a kind of secret plan behind closed doors. But also at a bigger point he was making about the cause of Brexit, about voters, disenfranchised voters in the coastal towns who feel the economy hasn't been working for them for, you know, years and years and years. So he was trying to tie what deal we make with Europe with what's been going on in the economy over a long period of time. Yeah. He did get stepped on a bit, though, because the Nissan announcement that they're going to build this new car in the Sunderland plant was released, I think, about 10 minutes before he stood up to speak, which was probably a bit irritating.
Because canny move by number 10 and by Greg Clark.
It did step on his limelight a bit.
And the interesting thing, didn't you think, was that just the passion with which John McDonnell talks about this subject, it is reminiscent of Lexit, Labour exit, Labour Brexit, and the Labour Leave campaign. You know, he's embracing Brexit, saying, look, this is a chance for us to shift the dial back in favour of the many, not the few, and not have a right-wing neoliberal economic approach to the world. It's like, it's not quite, it doesn't make you think actually that he was a yes voter in the referendum, right, let alone his boss.
No, it doesn't. I think when he's speaking, you can see he's not one of those Labour MPs that wants to rerun the referendum. And he says this a lot. You know, we're not going to do it again. We are leaving. But it's about getting the best deal, which he would see would be kind of a reshaping of the economy, using it as an opportunity almost to change what the consensus has been for so long.
Yeah. And Martha, another key Brexiteer, other than John McDonnell, closet Brexiteer, who's come back this week, is Michael Gove, the lovely Mr. Michael Gove. Now, he was elected onto the Brexit Select Committee. You were following that. Well, what do you think that will do to help his profile?
He's one of the team who's on that committee. He's kind of one of the most high profile, so that'll only work in his favour to get him back into the limelight. He's also kind of started appearing on broadcast programmes again. He was on The World at One saying that he'd welcome a chance to get back onto the front bench.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Particularly on the Brexit Select Committee. I think a role scrutinising what the government's doing over Brexit will not necessarily endear him to Theresa May.
Particularly on immigration. He said it was quite interesting. He's doing a new group. He's launching this today with Maurice Glassman, the Labour peer. He's talking about how actually there needs to be no special treatment for EU migrants under the new arrangements post-Brexit. And that's not what the Treasury is saying. They're saying, look, actually, we need these Europeans. We need the high skills. And he's being quite hardline. He's trying to say, look, he is trying to rerun the referendum in many ways and saying, look, you know, we won. This is what the people wanted.
Do you reckon he's joining the cabal against Hammond? Is he sort of siding with them, or is he just being Gove and off on his own kind of?
No, I think he's trying to help some of those people in cabinet. Not Boris, of course.
Yes. That committee's going to be interesting, isn't it? You've got Hilary Benn as the chair, kind of ardent Remainer, and then you've got Gove and Whittingdale and Raab, the kind of arch Brexiteers, alongside some Emma Reynolds, I think, is on it as well as a Labour Remainer. Yeah. How are they going to agree anything?
I mean, it's a vast committee, isn't it? And there have been some kind of MPs grumbling on the Remain side that the government that this has been engineered in order to make it just incredibly inefficient with all this vast number of dissenting voices, and it'll never get anything agreed.
Yeah, 21 people on a select committee. I mean, that's
all big names
pretty
as
big.
Well. Kind of, they're not.
Yeah, they're all going to. It's going to. Curiously, what it reminds me of is an EU summit where everyone gets to have their say. 27 people, you get around the table, and that actually, curiously, is the problem with the EU, according to a lot of Brexiteers. Here you have a 21-strong select committee.
Yeah, and it could end up being like the liaison committee, where you get all the heads of committees together to question the Prime Minister, and it's always the easiest thing for them to do, because it's just them with their egos wanting to make their point on the TV, rather than actually any coordinated scrutiny of what the policy is.
Exactly, and that's the problem. You know, Tony Blair famously used to knock the liaison committee, you know, across the park, and so did Cameron, because he knew what was coming. They do have advance notice of the topics, for example, and I suspect they won't have that in this case, in the Brexit Select Committee, but I don't think David Davis and or the Prime Minister, when they're called before it, will be necessarily quaking in their boots, should we say, because they'll know a lot of these people are going to want to make headlines. But It could be difficult. Let's see. I mean, let's see how much. If they just insist on stonewalling, for example, until March, then, you know, we're not going to get nowhere. But after that, it could be interesting, this committee. It could be the most interesting set of hearings we'll have in the entire Parliament. So let's see. Now, the other curious thing about Michael Gove, of course, is that in many ways, he is the guy who says, look, hard Brexit. He hates the phrase because, you know, it's makes a liberation sound like a punishment. I mean, and he said that on Sky News today, and he was interviewed by Adam Bolton. It was quite interesting that he was nailed again and again about his disloyalty and treachery towards Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I think his plan must be, as Martha's saying, if he wants to make a comeback, he knows he has to go through these questions in the first few interviews to kind of get out of the system. And then Adam Bolton was having great fun. I think at the end of the interview, he sort of said, well, that was a good laugh. I'm not quite sure whether Gove agreed, but you know, Gove, he did kind of admit it was a mistake for him to run for leader, and sort of he shouldn't have really done it in the way he did. But I suppose he just assumes, okay, these questions will come. I'll be kind of good humoured about it, and then people will get bored asking me about that.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, the mistake line, because he said not only was it a mistake for him to run, but he also admitted that, look, it was a mistake in terms of Boris for me either to have... I should have either paused before I supported Boris, or I should have maintained my support for Boris, yeah, and should have stuck by him. As the first glimmer of a sort of admission of guilt.
He was on World at One and yesterday, and he was asked if it was betrayal, and he said, you know, he kind of was trying to say he didn't betray Boris, and I was like, well, really? Because it's just not...
I know.
It's not a credible answer, is it?
I know. I think you should just apologise, say, I'm really sorry, admit the treachery, and then move on. I think that's the only way you can actually, you know, have a proper comeback. But let's see. Right. Okay, that's perfect time now to go on to the quiz. Ned, you've got a surprise for us.
Yeah, it's a quiz. It's about airports. It's called Heathrow. It's like Heathrow, or Heath High. What this is, so Heathrow's Northern Runway...
Yep.
Is 3,902 metres long. I'm going to give you some other airports in the world. And you're going to tell me whether the runway is longer or shorter than Heathrow.
Okay. So if it's 3,000 metres.
3,900.
Oh, okay, fine.
So if it's shorter, Heathrow, lower. Yeah. If it's longer, Heath High. That doesn't work as a name, but I can
think
do.
Of that. That'll do. That's good. Owen will be proud.
So, okay, so JFK, that's New York's airport, one of them, is that longer or shorter than Heathrow's longest runway?
Oh, shorter, right, yeah. Shorter, because it's on a sort of strip of
built
land,
up
isn't it?
Area. Yeah.
Is it good, sort of peninsula?
Good analysis. It's wrong. It's longer. It's 4,423.
God.
Okay, so how about Wellington in New Zealand?
Oh, my God, Ned. You've really trawled the net for this.
I'm going to say it's longer because it sounds like it's going to be...
This isn't
New Zealand.
Is Wellington built up? Is it near some mountains?
Wellington. I feel like it's probably got a lot of lovely countryside around it.
Yeah.
Which
long.
I think it's probably Heath High.
Heath High.
No, it's much shorter. It's 1,936. It's actually the runway's right by a big mountain. It's really scary.
I was wondering about the mountain point.
Okay, so how about Sydney?
I've actually flown into Sydney, but that won't help me at all. Sydney. Let's
longer or shorter?
I'm going to go for shorter.
Okay, well, I'm going to go for longer just to see who went.
It is longer, just. Oh. It's 3,962. So, and Heathrow's 3,902. So it's marginally. Okay, you
suppose got lots
of this
long
ridiculous
haul
question. Okay, so what about Bangkok?
Short. Shorter, definitely.
Yeah, must be shorter.
Surely built up.
Must be shorter.
You're right, it is, but only just. It's 3,700.
Uh-huh.
So there's a quiz about runway.
we're turning into plane spotters. Right, okay. Now, on to more serious matters. Now, there was an Opposition Day motion yesterday in the Commons. Nothing unusual about that. But what was unusual was that nearly half of the Labour Party failed to vote for their own motion. Emily Thornberry had called on the UK to, quote, suspend all support, close quotes, to the Yemeni government because of war crimes being committed by it and its Saudi allies. Now, here is the Shadow Foreign Secretary explaining her outrage at Foreign Minister Tobias Elwood's response to claims of an attack on innocent civilians.
Because when asked at the weekend about the latter incident, the Under Secretary of State, the member for Bournemouth East, called it, and I quote, a deliberate error, by which I believe he meant at least one individual within the coalition forces was able to deliberately unleash this terrible attack, killing 140 civilians without the authorisation of the coalition command in riot.
Now, Jeremy Corbyn raised Saudi Arabia in PMQs, his final two questions. He attacked the Saudi Arabian dictatorship, is what he called them. No, but what's striking about last night was just how many Labour MPs intervened on Thornbury, their own shadow foreign secretary, to say she misunderstood completely a complex situation and risked undermining it with sort of gesture politics. And it's quite interesting. I was told by some Labour MPs they'd all been sent a personal letter before that debate by the Yemeni ambassador pleading with them not to vote for it and saying this could really undermine the situation there. So that's why some of them decided not to back their own party. However, you know, this morning we see in the Times a front page photo, really awful photo of an 18-year-old girl, a Yemeni, who's been malnourished. Really shocking photo of the starvation that's going on there. It's not just people being raped and killed. There's a massive problem with food in parts of Yemen. And this is the forgotten war. There's no question about it. And it's interesting. I mean, what do you think, Ned? Do you think that Corbyn and Thornbury are right, maybe, to put this on the map? Is that what oppositions do? And particularly, I mean, I've seen online a lot of those Labour MPs who decided not to vote with their own party yesterday are being accused of being complicit in war crimes, being part of the old Blairite right. The fact that they, you know, they don't have a problem with their consciences on this. A lot of people, Corbynistas, are saying, look, that's what's wrong with the Labour Party. That's why Jeremy is what's right with the Labour Party.
I think the point about putting it on the map is maybe an interesting thing here. Now, whatever side of the vote you think you should have come down on, it has been the forgotten war. We've been so focused on Syria as much as even that and Aleppo.
Yeah.
What's been going on in Yemen has been totally ignored. And I think, is this the first time it's been this prominent on the front page of the papers?
I think that's true.
I can't think of a time when this war, this story, has been being the front page. So in that sense, yeah, I think what Corbyn's done there has worked. And if you remember, he did this before, didn't he? Last year, he raised Saudi Arabia and arms sales, in his first conference speech.
That's
and
true.
He had quite a bit of a success there because it did focus attention on what Britain's role in weapons sales were.
Yeah.
So it's probably what maybe he's trying to do again, is just to shift the focus a bit onto it. And I think that's a good thing. Whatever you think of the conflict itself, what side we should be doing,
and
I think
that
focus is necessary.
That conference speech, it was interesting that Michael Gove, who was then Justice Secretary, actually did change policy. We didn't renew a contract that we had between the British government and the Saudis. And it's quite interesting that on this, in PMQs, Corbyn made a slightly separate point from the debate in the Commons. He was talking about, you know, why should we be supporting Saudi Arabia being members of the UN Human Rights Committee? And it's coming up for re-election. And isn't this just ridiculous, the very idea that the Saudis could be on that? And he might be, I think some Labour MPs think he's on stronger ground there, even those who have worries about, you know, our arms ties and very important ties with the Saudis on intelligence. What do you think, Martha?
Well, I mean, I would agree that it's incredibly important that Labour has brought this up, and it's great that the focus has been shifted to it. But I think the empty gesture politics would hit home, because in fact, Thornbury didn't go as far as sort of suggesting that we shouldn't sell arms to Saudi Arabia.
Didn't.
She merely sort of, perhaps you can clarify on this what she did suggest, but it was sort of words like scrutiny and re-examine what we're doing. So I'm not quite sure what effect this will have, other than highlighting the issue.
Her motion important was specifically about supporting UK, pulling its support from the Yemeni government, you see.
Right.
So that was the focus. And she thinks that actually this is going to be a big area, the fact that the Saudis have these different spheres of influence. And she thinks she's the only Western, or certainly a British or American leading politician, to really push this issue. So she thinks she's going to be proved right in the long term, and that's why they had the vote yesterday, to embarrass the Tories into voting against it. But let's see. I mean, she's got quite a team around her who think strategically, so we don't know. But what was interesting was just that gap with the PLP. I mean, the sort of vitriol, people like John Woodcock, you know, Toby Perkins, Kevin Jones, they all intervened on her yesterday as if she was a Tory minister. And it was quite a thing. And she obviously got quite riled at one point. And I thought the significant thing was just the depth of that anger amongst them. It's almost as if, look, on foreign policy, we're not going to let this lie. On domestic policy, Jeremy, you can have what you like. We'll go quiet.
So that's interesting. Was it, you think, the kind of their anger, or how strong they intervened on her? Was that about this particular issue, or was it kind of a build-up of all the other foreign policy things that much of PLP disagree with, and this finally was the one they felt they could, you know, they kind of built up so much they would have had enough?
I think that's a good point. I mean, you're right. It plays into a wider worry amongst the PLP on things like Syria and Russia. For example, you know, only the other week, you know, we have Jeremy Corbyn's spokesman suggesting that there's Britain and the world's attention has been distracted by Aleppo away from the American war crimes, or rather the American civilian casualties. And only this week, Amnesty had a big report showing 300 civilian casualties as a result of American airstrikes in Syria. And it's interesting, both sides are digging in. You've got Corbyn and his team saying, look, we're right. Amnesty's proving we're right to say it's not just the Russians. And you've got the Labour PLP saying, actually, you're being incredibly naive about Russia. And I thought this week, it was interesting, you think, Martha, in PMQs, when Corbyn raised the Saudis, but the person who raised the Russians was Angus Robertson. And he was the one saying, you know, shouldn't we be putting pressure on the Spanish government not to help refuel this
aircraft carrier?
As a Russian carrier
sailed down the coast.
Yeah, and it worked because the Spanish did deny that permission in the end. So you've got Corbyn not mentioning it, you've got Angus Robertson mentioning it and getting a hit. I thought that was interesting.
I wonder if he didn't mention Russia because it would have given Theresa May she would have hit back with some kind of Russia joke about Corbyn. There might be bad taste given the situation.
Yeah, she might have. I mean, I thought it was significant that it's almost as if Russia is the thing that Corbyn won't speak about. But that's a difficult place to be if you're a Labour leader, isn't it?
In any leader, particularly Labour leader, you can't just ignore Russia.
But there is this wider problem, as we've just mentioned, between the PLP, the continuing sort of uneasy truce. I mean, I was at PLP this week, and they were outside it, and there's no real story. Just the previous week, it was all quiet. There's coming to an accommodation. They want to give Corbyn a fair wind, but on foreign policy, it's interesting. Ned, you interviewed Sam Tarry, one of Corbyn's leading lieutenants, and it was an in-depth interview, and he talked there about what he felt the PLP was doing wrong.
I think it's interesting. I think you're right. There is sort of this weird calm. I mean, it's not, relative to what has been going on in the party for the last year or so. It does seem to kind of just going through kind of parliamentary motions. And talking to Sam, who ran or helped to run Jeremy's second leadership campaign. He's a councillor in Barking. He works for the TSSA trade union as well. And he's quite critical of a lot of kind of the right of the PLP, just basically saying they've got no ideas. And it was interesting that his point was, even if what the Corbyn team is doing isn't perfect, and even if the kind of new left, around him isn't the ultimate solution, at least they've got something. Mm. Whereas his point was these other MPs have got nothing. They've got no analysis of the situation. They're not going to win an election either. So that's kind of the best chance of the party is this emerging new left.
He called them intellectually bankrupt.
It's very scathing, particularly scathing of Owen Smith's campaign. He's saying they just wanted to burn the party to the ground rather than let Corbyn win. Also interesting, he's very critical of how Labour runs elections. He just thinks on a practical way, whatever your kind of position in the party is ideologically, he just thinks the party's not fit to run an election campaign. He thinks it's lagging behind. And he was quite keen, to the irritation of many people in Labour HQ, I can tell you, saying that they need to kind of take the lessons of the Corbyn campaign and transfer them into Labour HQ, because the Corbyn campaign was very efficient and he thinks the Labour Party's not up to it. And this kind of, like I said, has not gone down great.
Well, certainly what is he's got right is that in the leadership campaign, the Corbyn team were efficient. They had key messages. They characterise Owen Smith within hours as a Blairite, pharmaceutical manufacturer. They got their framing perfect, but they're also very efficient on social media. They knocked it out of the park on Facebook as well as Twitter in terms of organising people and turning up at rallies. Now, the big challenge, of course, is can you translate that beyond the Labour membership to, average
Joe? Interesting thing, I think. If you run Corbyn's plan, you know that audience, you know the Labour Party audience and how to win over them. Is that necessarily the same thing as knowing how to win over voters at large, and do the same methods and the same approach work? To what social media, he was very keen on the idea that in Scotland, he said the Scottish Tories had a really effective campaign. They use Facebook really well. Now, Labour Party is actually kind of starting to do some of this stuff better and better. They've got plans to do some of what Tarry was talking about. So whether this is him sort of sending a message, being we need to do it quicker, I don't know. But whether they can, can you transfer that Corbyn campaign to a general election?
I don't know. They obviously think they can. What was interesting, you say Labour HQ was irritated by the interview. I can tell you Labour MPs were very irritated by it, because one told me that hey, we're all intellectually bankrupt, have you heard? And they didn't go down that well. But then again, I suppose Sam Tower didn't mean it to go down that well.
No.
The interesting thing is, and we're coming full circle here, Martha, there's been some gossip that Sam Tarry could be the Labour candidate in Richmond in the by-election.
Well, in the interview, yeah, he said he might like to run for an MP and he's been pressured to do it. So some of the moderates are saying, go on then, here's your chance.
Yeah, Richard Angel from Progress has wrote a blog for us this week saying, you know, he knows Sam of old. I think they're old sparring partners from student union days. But he said, look, well, all right, put your money where your mouth is. Let's see if this works in Richmond. Which, to be honest, I talked to some moderate people within Labour HQ who said, actually, it's not that mad an idea. He is a really good campaigner.
He's a really good campaigner.
Charismatic.
He's a very good public speaker as
well. Very charismatic. He might actually, you know, he's the perfect embodiment of where Corbyn is right now. He'd be a great sort of shop window for Corbynism.
And I mean, is that going to go down well in Richmond?
Well,
it's a better idea than not putting up a candidate at all, which was the rim for a little while.
I know, curious. I think the big problem in Richmond is... as someone who lives there, is again the John McDonnell point about bankers Brexit. If people in Richmond think that Labour is anti the City of London, when many of them rely on jobs in the City of London and Canary Wharf, and they're not fat cat bankers, a lot of them are in tech jobs, they're in, you know, supply side jobs, some of them, you know, they're even secretarial jobs. And there are 100,000 jobs linked to the city. McDonnell admitted that this morning. I think in Richmond that might not really work as a sell. But
I think, save that for somewhere else in the country.
We'll see. Anyway, well, it's going to be an interesting by-election. So on that note, I thank you all for listening and we'll see you all next week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.